The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
It's been just under 18 months since Leo Varadkar took to the steps outside Leinster House to make a surprise announcement. He was done with politics. At 45 years of age, the Dublin West TD was ready to step away from his role as Taoiseach, as leader of Fine Gael and public representative. Still, it marked just over 20 years in elected office for this Dublin GP, who now has recounted many of the tales from that period in a new memoir, which is called Speaking My Mind. And Leo Varadkar joins me now. Leo, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks.
I found it a very entertaining read, by the way. I wasn't expecting it to be entertaining.
Oh, well, thank you, because I did want to make it a book that's readable and accessible. You know, somebody will write the history book in next year or 5 or 10 years' time. I wanted to write, you know, it in a way that's a story and people can read. And
you take a lot of stuff on the chin, criticisms that were offered to you over the years. And we'll come to those kind of criticisms and your responses. But what interested me most about all of this is that you wanted to be Taoiseach from a teenager.
I definitely wanted to be a politician. I'm not sure I necessarily knew that I'd get to be Taoiseach, but I definitely wanted to.
But that ambition formed
very early,
didn't it?
As you know, the book starts with me going down to vote with my mum in School Breed of Blanchardstown. I think it was the 1987 election. I probably therefore must have been 8 years old and was already then fascinated by politics, elections, posters, leaflets. Would have been aware the Ardèche was on, believe it or not, you know, and that would not have been a normal 8 year old, I don't think.
No, and then you decided you want to be in politics, and you became an intern with Francis Fitzgerald, who then fast forward, and I'm jumping around a bit, but fast forward, then you have to accept her resignation.
Yeah, that's a big fast forward.
It is, but I mean, someone who mentored you and who brought you in subsequently, after your internship, she brought you in as a researcher when you were in college and so on. So she kind of got you into politics.
We had a personal relationship for sure. That was a very unpleasant week or two, much worse for her than it was for anyone else, needless to say.
But it demonstrates how vicious a business politics can be.
Yeah, it can be a blood sport. You know, and ultimately, she should not have had to resign. But because we were a minority government and the majority in the Dáil at the time, which was Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, wanted her resignation, it was a case of having an election or saving the government. And she chose to save the government and to allow us to avoid an election, which what would have been very complicated.
But the question is, would you have sacked her?
No. Oh, no, if we had a majority government, absolutely not.
No, but if she hadn't offered her resignation, would you have sacked her?
Well, thankfully that didn't arise. Yeah, that's a tough question. Yeah, thankfully that didn't arise.
Mm. Now, when you go back to your early days and you want to be a councillor, and you actually do run for the council at one point, and you come, it's a co-option kind of thing, or it's a one-off election, and you fail. And then you have to, you call it the walk of shame, I think. You're looking at your own posters on the lampposts.
Yeah, there's a 1999 election, 20 years old, thought I'd do everything. Decided I'd run for election, not even in the area I lived in the area next door. So I wasn't, even the family wasn't well known. And that's an important thing in Irish politics in particular, you know, your local connections and your family get your first couple of hundred votes. And lost, came in sixth. Interestingly, just behind a guy called Paul Donnelly, who's now head at the Sinn Féin TD in Dublin West. So people are around for a long time sometimes before they get elected. And that was true for both of us. And I remember that. Yeah, like, you know, you don't just go away from the count centre having lost the election. You then have to get up the next day and the day after
the posters are still there
and take down the posters. And, you know, you'd even have kids pointing at you, you know, saying, you know, you lost, you know, and like, what do you say, you know? So now, when I became sports minister, I actually reflected that politics is very like high performance sport. You know, you train for ages, it builds up to this one really big event, and then, you know, you either perform and win on the day or you don't. Yeah. The difference in politics is that there's no sports psychologist
there. And I've been watching,
there's nobody there to pick up the pieces.
Watching the athletics over the weekend in Tokyo, and you think that someone has trained for really 2 years maybe to make sure they're fit for it. And then on the day...
Yeah, it mightn't be your best day, yeah.
Mightn't be
but
your
the
best
difference
day.
For them, and, you know, this isn't a criticism of them, it's a criticism of politics, is they all have sports psychologists and teams around them and all the rest of it. Politics isn't well structured like that. You know, You know, the phone just stops ringing.
Now you, I don't think, have the reputation of being ruthless, but you still have to do some hard things, and you have done some difficult things. But even in your early days, the Sheila Terry thing, which you write about in the book, I mean, she was someone who brought you in, really, to politics, and then you run against her, get the nomination, and get the seat. When you look back on that, and you kind of write it off as a bit of maybe immaturity, that you didn't handle it well, that you didn't maybe tell her.
Yeah, I didn't handle it well. You know, she was the local councillor in the area, and then was elected to the Senate, and then I was co-opted to her council seat, and she was very kind to me, and I worked very hard for her as well, and taught me a lot about local politics in particular, the kind of stuff that I didn't know about, and the nomination to run for the Dáil came up. And I went for it and I got it. And, you know, not surprisingly, the party members wanted me to have it because I'd come up through the system, you know, had been dropping leaflets since I was 16, whereas she had come in from the outside, had previously been a PD. But I wasn't upfront about it. I should have done the right thing. Should have done, you know, should have manned up and sat down and met her and said, look, you know, I want to go for this. I think I have a better chance of winning the Dáil seat. The members are behind me. And the kind of person she is, she might even have come in behind me had I done that. And I didn't do that, and that's a lingering regret. We're back in touch, you know, which is good, but we weren't for a long period of time.
How many people do you think you're not in touch with on foot of your political career? People that you knew and worked with and were close to?
Well, I suppose there's two answers to that. Like, there's loads of people I'm not in touch with because they were never friends anyway. Yeah. You know, it's a workplace. You change jobs. Some people you keep in touch with. Some people you don't. Now, there's very, very few people that there's almost nobody that I want to be in touch with that I'm not in touch with, to put it that way, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. But political enemies, I mean, do you look back on events and say, well, if I'd handled this differently, they still might be talking to me? I mean, you are talking to Lucinda Creighton again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We were at a friend's wedding together there the other day. I was in her house over the summer. I know we're good friends. Now, obviously we fell out around the time she left Fine Gael and set up a new party, Renew, and ran against us and tried to take us out of government, you know. So obviously that was a time when we just weren't in touch. We didn't like have we weren't having a row or anything, but, you know, we were able to reconnect again. But that's a long time ago since we
like many of the things
again.
That you did, they always had, if you like, the political objectives in mind. You're a GP, you buy your first apartment in Carpenterstown in Castleknock, and it really has to be in the constituency.
Yeah,
like even though you might have a medical career ahead of you.
Like, I wouldn't want that to sound too calculating. Like, it's not unusual for people to want to live, you know, within a few kilometres of their parents and their family if they can afford to do so. And thankfully, I could. But it definitely was a consideration, that I was going to run for election, and therefore you don't have to, but it does make sense, and it is beneficial to make sure that you live in the area you're going to want to represent.
Mm. Now, you write in the book about your interview with Miriam McCallum, where you came out as a gay politician for the first time. And subsequently, you know, the reporting and a lot of the articles have picked this up, but it's clearly in the book that you felt it was almost like emigration, that you were moving from one country into another.
Yeah, like, it was a huge, it was a big change, more so than I thought it would be. You know, I thought I was going to do this interview, you know, get it out of the way. You know, there you go. You know, I like wearing green suits, you know, it doesn't really matter, and that it wouldn't change my life.
But you were a little bit apprehensive about it, because there was that moment when you had to decide, do I do it? I can still back off, you know, when she asks you about that you might meet somebody someday.
I think at that stage she probably wasn't going to let me back off, but and we had talked about it a few days beforehand, you know, just after a primetime episode, I think it was. So I did particularly want her to do the interview. You know, I think Miriam's a very, very, very smart person, but also a very empathetic person, you know, and I thought I'd be able to answer the questions coming from her than, you know, more so than maybe from somebody else.
No, but that point is that you made the decision and the world didn't fall apart as it might have done.
Well, quite the reverse. And this wasn't the intention. I just wanted to get it out there, be able to live my life, be able to be honest about the referendum campaign that was coming up, you know, that this wasn't a technical question about whether other people can get married. It's, you know, it's something personal to me. So that's kind of why I wanted to have it out there. But I, you know, but you know, in some ways, it became a bit of a positive in politics. Not sure it would be now, you know, given the conservative backlash at the moment. But Ireland was entering a more liberal phase at that stage, and you know, it helped to make me a bit different and to stand out from other politicians. But that wasn't what it was about. I was worried that it would be negative, but I did want to make sure that
it's interesting the observation you make about what happened afterwards. Your father, you think maybe he knew all along. Your mother, her concern was that it would damage your possibilities of ever being Taoiseach.
Yeah, which was strange. Now,
your sisters, they hadn't a clue, but their husbands always thought it, you know.
Yeah. that's right. And it was interesting just to see, you know, across the board with friends, it was 50-50. Like one half were like, yeah, actually, we know that. We're just waiting for you to tell us. And the other half were, you know, really surprised. And I couldn't have guessed which ones were going to be in which category. Now, for my mum, look, it didn't take her more than a few hours to come around. It was just a bit of a shock and a bit of a surprise. And,
but her concern was that it would damage you politically.
Yeah, I know, and that wasn't my particular concern, you know. Yeah. So I didn't realise that she was so ambitious for me at the time, but I guess she was.
Now, you address all the controversial elements of your personal and political life. I mean, you talk about that kiss in the nightclub. You talk about Matt's unfortunate tweeting when you're on the way to the coronation and matters like that.
That was Instagram, yeah. So we should
Instagram.
Give full credit to Meta Corporation.
But the point is that you take these things on.
Yeah.
Do you think that was important so that people wouldn't be criticising you for running and hiding behind the covers of a book?
I know it was important for two reasons. You know, one, if I left certain things out, and I did have to leave a lot out, by the way, you know, 25,000 words ended up on the cutting room floor. But if I left certain things out, people would just want to talk about the stuff I left out. So I said, no, I'm going to put everything in, including the controversies. But also, you know, I read political biographies myself. You know, I like to read people's biographies. And I just noticed one or two, you know, where they totally glossed over certain controversies. And I thought, you know, that's poor form. You know, how can you leave that out? And so I thought, okay, look, I have to put everything in here. Mm.
And some of the stuff that you may have written about, which ended up on the cutting room floor, I wondered about, because you have, you talk about Claire Daly, you and she got on actually very well. And
yeah, she came to the launch, actually, last week.
But then there's a footnote, you know, as to Claire's, since she became an MEP and what happened afterwards, that's a whole other story, or words to that effect in a footnote. And that, you know, that's a whole book, probably.
Yeah, and hopefully she'll write a book, because I think she'd have a very interesting story to tell. But I got to know Claire Daly first. We were both on Fingal County Council at the same time. I'm obviously had very different politics, came from very different perspectives. But I always felt she was straight up. You know, you knew where you stood with her. And then also on certain things, you know, she was very brave. You know, she was campaigning for abortion rights when it was dangerous to do so and certainly not popular to do so. She was very strong on, you know, issues of Garda corruption and so on. You know, she does have courage. Now, I would totally absolutely disagree with her on a lot of things, particularly on foreign policy. But you can have respect for somebody that you profoundly disagree with.
Now, when I asked you about the people that you don't really talk to anymore or don't talk to you, I mean, Phil Hogan would be one of those, wouldn't he?
Yeah, no, that's as much as his choice as mine.
That's
you know?
About Golfgate and all of that. And, you know, the fact that he was exonerated, it shows that some of the political winds that blow can be very temporary gusts. And if you can actually get through them, they might not sink you, but it sank Phil Hogan.
Yeah, that's true. And as you rightly point out, the district court found that nobody had committed a crime. I don't think Phil was ever even charged of that. Like, so, you know, that's a different thing. Like, there's the hotel that was actually charged for that. But there's more to politics than committing crimes. You know, most people, if they're forced to resign for some reason, it's because of, you know, something they did or said or poor professional performance and so on. And I think what Phil subsequently did, you know, was to blame me and Micheál Martin for his resignation, you know, accused us of populism and so on. And I don't accept that interpretation. You know, people should, even when your resignation may have been unfair, you have to at least at some level say, was there something I did that was wrong or foolish? You know, should I have been there? Might I have handled it better after the fact?
Swingate.
Yeah.
classic example of that, do you think?
I feel very bad for Maria. You know, she was really horribly pilloried for all of that. I don't think she should have sued the hotel for falling off a swing while she was holding alcohol. I'm sorry, like, I just don't think people should do that. And certainly if they're in public office, they should they should drop that kind of thing right away. You know, it's just a bad idea. And I think she was ill-advised. But again, I think she was blaming advice sometimes. And like, you can't, I don't think you can do that in politics. You get advice, but you make the decision and you're then responsible for your actions.
Mm. People would say she was on a swing with a bottle of something in her hand. Mm. She fell off and she took legal action. On the other hand, you were caught kissing a guy who was not Matt in a nightclub.
Mm.
And they say in another era, you would have been toast.
Maybe now, look, I don't know. You know, all these things are different. You know,
do you think there's a misunderstanding? Maybe, like, everyone who's kind of heterosexual thinks, if my fella or if my girl did that on the dance floor and I'm standing over at the bar, not alone would the political career would be toast, but the personality would be toast.
Well, look, like Matt and I have a very good relationship. We're 10 years together now, going strong. You know, there are other people in politics whose marriages have broken down and, you know, and they've gone on to have other relationships. So I don't think that's an absolute by any means.
I want to talk to you about Brexit because the excerpt that they published in the Sunday Times yesterday, which is a riveting, who could think that Brexit would be riveting? But the idea that the British may have been eavesdropping on the Irish delegation.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm very careful how I phrase that in the book. And what I say, and this is the case, is that we know there are certain governments, five or six, the UK government is one of them, that has the capacity to read other people's emails, listen to what they're saying on their phones, and they have used it. We know from WikiLeaks, for example, that they've used it not just to monitor enemies, but also allies. And we took the view that if they had this technology, it was safer for us to work on the assumption that they might use it in this context. You know, Brexit was an existential question for the UK. So our approach was very clear, sort of careful about what we wrote down. Phones were never allowed in the room during important discussions. But also, crucially, we didn't have a private strategy and a public strategy. And often in politics or in negotiation, you know, you have your public line, which is what you say, and you have your private line, which is what you might agree to. And we were always very clear that we only had a very clear line on this, that there would not be a hard border between North and South in any circumstances, that Ireland's position in the single market would not be diminished. And I think there were people in the UK who made the mistake of believing, particularly in the kind of pro-Brexit press, that the Irish just needed a ladder to climb down, to use the term used by one paper. I don't think the British government ever thought that.
All right. So, I mean, Theresa May goes out to make a phone call and she goes into a little tent that was obviously leak-proof. The whole theme of leaks comes through again and again. You know, you talk about telling, when you were Taoiseach, saying no mobile phones at cabinet meetings, into a box outside, a bit like the pouches for schools and all that.
Yes,
but anyway, no mobile phones.
Which at least means the leaks happened before and after the meeting and not during it, but yeah.
You make that point precisely. But in terms of your own deliberate leak, this was about the IMO and the GP, the other GP organisation, and you passed on some information, which you admit to doing, but seeing that as part of a process. When you were investigated by the Gardaí and interviewed twice, and the length of time it took to investigate you and finally exonerate you, you've figured that might have been a bit of get back at you, revenge for your stance on Maurice McCabe, the whistleblower.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I talk about that in the book, and I think that's more a reflection of my state of mind than any particular conspiracy theory that I was believing. I was really surprised that there was a Gard investigation at all. I wasn't surprised that SIPO looked at it from an ethical point of view, but, you know, the idea that it was a crime.
If every politician who leaked was charged.
Yeah. Not to mention all the journalists who could be questioned under caution, have their phones taken off them. And this has never happened, you know. So I was surprised that, surprised that there was an investigation at all. And I thought it would then be very quick. and it didn't. It went on for over a year. It involved, you know, a huge amount of Garda time and Garda resources, which might have been used on other things, quite frankly. And they really went down every angle you could possibly imagine. So anyone who got interviewed who mentioned anyone, that person then got interviewed. So it went on forever. And, you know, I kind of wondered why they go on so long. Like maybe they weren't that busy, you know, but I doubt it. Sure, they have other things to do. Maybe they were just being very thorough. Maybe they're very slow at doing their work for reasons of professional standards. But across my mind on occasion that, you know, were there people, you know, in senior parts of the Gardaí who had a grievance with me over the Maurice McCabe issues.
It's interesting that every day is, I always say in this job, every day is a school day. But for you, even as a Taoiseach, every day can be a learning day. When Helen McEntee, you suggest that she might step down from her office because she's having a baby and she will be absent for a while taking maternity leave. And she looks at you and said, do you think really you have to lose your job because you're having a baby? And that was learning for you.
Yeah, well, actually, Helen came back to me about that since. And she says I don't do myself a fair service in the book. And her recollection of it is better, that I was more supportive than you would think in the book. So maybe half that conversation was in my head. You know, one thing you learn when you're writing a book is memory isn't exact. It's not like a video recording. And sometimes you can't remember the stuff you actually said out loud and the stuff that you actually said to the person. But initially, you know, this had never happened before. We'd never had a cabinet member become pregnant while in office. And, you know, my initial thought was, okay, look, this is fine. Take your maternity leave as you should. You know, stay a TD, obviously, but step back as a minister for 6 months and I'll appoint a new minister to fill in for you. And she was very resistant to that idea and she was right. And she said that sends a really bad message to women and to families. And I think it took about 30 seconds for me to realise she was spot on. And we found a new solution, which was to have another minister double up for.
Finally, I mean, there's so much, if you like, hard politics in the book. But, you know, when I look through all the things that you went through, we had cervical check, we had repealed the eighth, we had Savita Halappanavar, we had the saga of the children's hospital. So many things are really social affairs that kind of can make you or break you.
Yeah, like I guess that's true. You know, it's was it Macmillan who said events,
dear boy, events,
and you know, so much in politics. You know, I say in the book that you can divide the job into three parts. You know, one which is keeping things going, the economy humming, public services operating. The third is you know, finding space for the stuff you want to do. And the big thing in the middle is all the stuff that just comes at you. The pandemic, Brexit, Ukraine, none of these things were ever in any programme for government. Inflation. And you have to deal with them.
Well, as I say, it's a very readable book, which is great for a political memoir. It's called Speaking My Mind. It's published by Sandy Cove and its author, former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Thank you very much for joining us in studio.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.